This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you read Krista Tippett's official bio, it says she avoids easy answers to her questions. Okay, before you're tempted to breezily dismiss that description, you have to remember she chooses really difficult questions to answer, like, what does it mean to be human? A Fulbright scholar, she went to study politics in Cold War Europe, became a stringer in Berlin for the New York Times, has been a correspondent for Newsweek, the International Herald Tribune, and the BBC, but she really made a name for herself because she recognized a void in talking about something many people avoid, religion. She imagined intellectual radio conversations about religion, about spirituality, about faith. The result has been her public radio program, On Being, which you hear here every Sunday morning at 7, and several books on the topic. In this increasingly secular society, one in which the basis for many contemporary political battles is religion, these conversations have taken on more importance than perhaps even she imagined. And these political arguments have become increasingly uncivil, so Krista Tippett has launched her Civil Conversations Project to help us all talk across our differences. Her next stop is Charlotte, right here in the Duke Energy Theater at Spirit Square, right now on Charlotte Talks. Krista Tippett, welcome back to the program.
Well, I'm so glad to be with you again, Mike, and to be in Charlotte again, and to be at WFAE.
And I want to thank First Presbyterian Church, yes, who made you available to us. You were here last night to speak to a standing room only crowd. Is that the case everywhere you go?
Recently it has been true.
People are desperate to hear something.
You know what? I think at the moment it feels really important to us to be in rooms with other people talking about things that matter.
Wow. Politics and religion are two topics that when I was growing up, we were told, don't ever talk about those things.
Yeah.
And we didn't, pretty much. We kind of avoided that, except in the immediate family. And even that was uncomfortable sometimes. But now politics is everywhere. It's on the radio. It's on the television. It seems to be the cause of a lot of anger and frustration and mean-spiritedness. Mm. Is that why that we were told to avoid discussing it in the first place, do you suppose?
Wasn't it money, politics, and
money.
Religion?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we talk about money all the time, everywhere.
Right.
I think we used to, didn't you grow up, saying that you would never, that who you voted for was a very private matter,
right?
That was too private a question to ask someone. And I think we've all kind of come out of the closet with our political lives.
Yeah, and as we have, the conversation has become really rough. I was trying to find a good word to use and not use the word I was thinking of. It's really rough, and it's culminated in this last election cycle. All the rules of polite society seem to have gone out the window. Why?
Well, you know, we've been building to this for a long time. There's something about this political moment where everything is out on the surface. But, you know, we started the Civil Conversations Project in early 2011.
Really?
Yeah, and because 2010 was also one of these toxic religion political seasons. But the difference is back then we were really surprised about it. We were just shocked. And then there was the shooting of Representative Gabrielle Giffords.
Right.
In early 2011. You know, what I was aware of at that time is in the wake of that shooting, there were beautiful speeches that were heartfelt by the president and everyone else, people on all sides of the political spectrum, saying we needed to rediscover civil dialogue, we needed to rediscover civility. But what I was aware of is we didn't really know how to do that, and we didn't see it embodied anywhere. And so so there was this longing that was out there, and then within a couple of months, we went back to business as usual, and we've kind of devolved to the place we're in now.
I mean, are our memories really that short? Because you said that we don't have any role models either in any of our institutions anymore. They're all kind of changing and morphing. And I remember when things were civil. I'm sure you remember when things were civil. Why doesn't the public at large? Why don't they?
I think what we I talked about this last night. And you know, something I think about a lot is that we, for 50 years, which actually is not a long time, historically speaking, we've been making these baby steps of pluralism. We're figuring this out. And what we did after the 60s is we enshrined the virtue of tolerance. But tolerance, and you know, in Europe, it's multiculturalism, and they're having the same issues we are. These things were really about saying, okay, we're all in the room together and we honor our diversity, but it wasn't actually about engaging. It, you know, tolerance is allowing, enduring, indulging. And I think the place we're at now, and it's just on full display in our political life, is what we have to learn now is how do we figure out how to live together? Like, what does civility mean? What does civil discourse mean if we aren't standing on common ground and have passionately held serious differences, and yet we make a commitment to live together, and we decide that how we treat each other has value, even as we continue to disagree? That's actually not the way we've treated dialogue or debate or political life.
You launched the Civil Conversation series, as you said, in 2011. How have those conversations changed over these last 6 years?
Well, you know what? Oh, you know, I should take these bracelets off. This is my producers always get mad at me on my radio show when I have them on.
Me too. That's why I don't wear mine.
What I tried to do, which is what I like to do, which is kind of take a long view and step back from the drama of the moment, and also identify the questions that are out there and the questions that are still going to be with us a few months from now when the news cycle has moved on. So with the Civil Conversations Project, you know, I've talked to poets and philosophers, mm-hmm. And technologists about, you know, the large question of how do we live in this moment, which helps get at the question of how do we live together. But actually next week's show is a 2017 style civil conversation that I had in Seattle just about a week ago at something called the Citizen University, mm-hmm. with a Tea Party libertarian and a really wonderful millennial, very progressive activist.
How'd that go?
Actually, well, you can listen. It was great. But here's the thing. These two, I think they model what we all have to figure out. I think of them as bridge people. And I think a lot of us would like to be bridge people. And I think bridge people are all around us. They don't make the headlines.
What does that mean, bridge people?
I mean people who, I'm not interested anymore. I'm not interested. But, you know, so these are not people who don't have opinions, right? I mean, I don't know. Is there a political center? Is it interesting if it exists? I think most of us have some kinds of positions and passions, and we need to be able to carry those robustly. I think bridge people are probably not on the farthest end of their spectrum, whatever that spectrum is. And they carry their questions openly alongside their convictions. How would I describe these two? They carry their questions alongside their convictions. They have passionate convictions, but they have a real curiosity. They have a commitment to understanding and being in conversation with people on the other side. Conversation is not the same thing as debate, and I don't even think it's the same thing as dialogue. But it's possible. It's absolutely possible.
Have you found in having these conversations where you have people on both sides of the aisle or the spectrum that minds have been changed or eyes have been opened, or do people leave with their preconceived notions intact?
See, that's what we have to let go of.
Really?
Yeah. No, look, this is such an American way of approaching things. Like, we think we should dedicate an hour
That's enough.
And there will be resolution. You know, my view will hold sway. Somebody's mind will be changed.
And room for 22 minutes of commercial.
It doesn't work that. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it leaves us feeling like we're failing all the time. We have work to do just to get to know each other, just to understand how other people's minds tick, why they behave they do. And I think we should be curious about that and also committed to that because we share the world with them, because they're fellow citizens. And I don't think we even know how to have the real substantive, deep, in fact, transformative conversations we want to have down the road until we establish some basis of relationship and a trustedness between us.
But we need these conversations today. Did we need them 25, 30 years ago? We seem to be in better shape 25 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know.
So
I think
what's happening today that we suddenly need to talk these things out because we're on two sides of a wall that we can't penetrate.
Yeah, but I also think that this peace we've had was not the whole story. We've been able to live a long time here with a lot of really deep trauma going on for certain people, you know, different kinds of people that wasn't being acknowledged or owned in our midst, but was real. And I'm talking about, you know, what we, I think, demeaningly call the Rust Belt, like the way we talk about places people come from and love, you know, the people on the losing end of the globalization equation. I'm talking about the fact that we, you know, I think of let me just finish my sentence. That, you know, we've felt for the last 20 years like we'd kind of figured this racial thing out. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was still some work to do, but we'd come so far, and we have come so far. But we shifted the color line that W.E.B. Du Bois said was the question of the 20th century, the problem of the 20th century. We shifted the color line in terms of laws, but what we've learned now about ourselves through our science, and also we see it manifest, is that there's a color line in our heads. And we haven't actually shifted that. Like, that's the work now. And the great thing about now is we actually have this knowledge. So, you know, we elected an African-American president, in fact, a biracial president, which was this monumental, you know, I think that's just this magnificent accomplishment given the history of this country. And I think so many people around the world and so many people on both sides of the political spectrum experience it that way. But I think what the last 8 years surfaced was all the unfinished business, the work we still have to do on ourselves to be worthy of that accomplishment. So to me, you know, you can look at all the political events that have converged right now. To me, politics is a symptom of this human drama that has been building.
Hmm. But not all of it is about color. Not all of the disagreements.
No.
A lot of it is based on religious belief, and that's really your bailiwick. I mean, you've been talking on being about religion and faith and spirituality for years. When we come back from the break, I want to talk about that and what role that is playing in this and the fact that we're becoming a more secular society. And can these two things peacefully coexist? Krista Tippett is our guest, host of On Being on NPR and WFAE Sunday mornings at 7. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Miles McClellan Construction, dedicated to meeting each of their clients' needs when it comes to project performance and its technical requirements. More information about Miles McClellan's approach at mmbuildings.com. And from the Royal Gardens, offering an array of containers, fountains, and fairy garden accessories to the Charlotte community since 1994. More at royalgardenscharlotte.blogspot.com. The South is home to the largest chunk of the American population, 122 million people. And although many come from other parts of the country, many of them identify as being Southern. So what does it mean to be a Southerner in the 21st century? Tomorrow morning on Charlotte Talks, two researchers who use social science tools answer that question. We hear about what they found, how Southern identity has changed over time, and what happens when Yankees put down roots here. When Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump takes on the Freedom Caucus. Will he work with Democrats instead? Should Democrats work with him? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That conversation on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're at the Duke Energy Theater in Spirit Square today because Krista Tippett from On Being is with us, and also, I'm not a good estimator of crowds, but I think maybe 50 of our favorite people are here. Maybe more. I have no idea what this theater seats. I don't know. Maybe 99 of our favorite people. And you're our favorite people too. Those of you who are listening on the radio, and you can join us on Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks, or you can send us an email just as you normally would at WFAE, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. So just before the break, we were talking about, I brought up the topic of are becoming a more secular society. And you spend time talking to people of faith and spirituality. And as we've become more secular, a lot of the arguments that we're having about gay marriage, about abortion, you name it, have their foundation in religious belief. When you have people who have this deep-seated belief, and you have people who are more secular and don't have those beliefs, how do you meet in the middle?
You know, I actually think it's kind of striking how the politicized religious voice has not been such a force in the last election. So many things about this last election were different.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put.
It's true that for white evangelicals who voted for Donald Trump, this is what people say, and I believe them, very much about abortion as a decisive, about the pro-life stance, mm-hmm. as a decisive factor. I don't see religion playing the same kind of role when it comes to gay marriage anymore in the same way. I mean, I was on Indivisible, this show. Are you airing that in WFAE?
I honestly don't know.
Okay. It's a kind of NPR collaboration. Right. It's also a podcast. It's coming out of public radio about religion and politics right now. And and a lot of people called in from all over the country. And I to me, what came through in those calls and what I think about so much is, we do have this history of the last 30 years of politics and religion, which in my mind, so much of it has distorted both politics and religion. Mm-hmm. It's religious voices and positions squeezed into political formats. What came through in this call, when people were calling from all parts of the country, is how imperfectly, in fact, religious values and virtue actually align with political issues. But we have forced that alignment. That alignment has been forced. And it's been bad for us. What I long for, and what I think a lot of the new non-religious, which is what I call, this Pew poll-driven category of the N-O-N-E-S, the nuns.
Right.
People who's 30% of people under 30, and an increasing number of people older than 30 who say they don't affiliate with a religious tradition. I experience a lot of spiritual energy and theological curiosity and passion for service in that world, mm-hmm. but people who are really fed up with precisely this dynamic. with religion, which is not rising to its best ideals right. in the public square.
I was thinking about this yesterday. I was going to ask you if you thought, because we're moving toward this more secular side of things, that has given permission to people who don't have a foundation in faith to say whatever they damn well please, and consequences notwithstanding. But then I thought, you know, there are a lot of people of deep faith who've been having these conversations and who have been saying things that are out of character.
And who say what they damn well please.
Exactly right.
Yes.
How do you explain that? Because it's out of character for them, it seems to me, more so than it would be for
out of character for religious people?
Yes. Because it's been an uncivil conversation.
Yeah, well, out of character in the sense that it flies in the face of Christian tradition.
Yes.
Yeah. But Americans have entangled these things. Like, we've entangled citizenship and American values and Christian values so that we can hardly pull them apart anymore. And here's the other thing. I also hold journalism accountable for this, too, because... there are so many good people living their religious lives in honorable ways, trying to be true to the depths of that tradition, and they don't make the news.
Right.
Right? It's a few strident voices who make the news, and in fact, who journalists, you know, take their camera phones and cameras and microphones to these people. So the full story of religion is below what we call the radar. Mm-hmm. And it's less discouraging.
And as you point out, like when you talk about your civil conversations, that could turn some people off because they don't want to participate in some mamby-pamby little thing where we all agree or shake hands even though we hate each other.
Yeah.
You think that civil conversations can be muscular.
Well, they have to, or they will be namby-pamby and irrelevant. So we have to, I mean, you know, a lot of the words that describe the things that we need the most and, in fact, that we want the most, like peace and justice and love mm-hmm. and civility, are kind of ruined words. They've just been politicized and watered down and become superficial. Some of them, though... Some of these words we can't not use them, right? Like, we need the word civility. I think we need the concept of civility in our midst, and so we have to resurrect it, to use some religious language.
Right.
And it does have to be muscular, and it cannot be too tame or mild or polite. In a nutshell, I think its qualities would be that we understand we really have to learn how to engage difference. Which is different from, you know, one of the things we've done a lot in the last few decades is celebrate diversity, which often meant that we just focus on the things we have in common, which leaves us with kind of the tip of the iceberg of ourselves and very superficial.
Right.
So we actually have to engage also what is truly different about us, including what is hard and uncomfortable. But to do that in a spirit of genuine curiosity, of a willingness to be surprised... of a willingness to have our stereotypes shaken up, a willingness to take in some ambiguity. It's not that we have to go into the room ready to have our mind changed, and we also can't go into the room ready to change the other. But to go into the room wanting to understand each other, that would be a new move in our public life.
Things change every day, but human beings need signposts to tell them that this is the beginning of something new. Mm-hmm. And at the turn of the last century, a lot of things began to change. I know, I remember it.
You're not talking about...
Joke. the turn of the 19th to the 20th century.
That's right. I was going to say.
Please.
Right.
But you've called us, because we just experienced the turn of the century. You've called us turn of the century people.
We are. Yeah.
And you've described this as a terrifying and wondrous century, and we're being hit with questions that we thought we'd answered mm-hmm. in the 20th century. What are those questions that we thought we'd answered that suddenly we're discovering maybe we didn't?
God, I think just so many of the answers that we thought we had, and you know, we even the way we'd figured out our institutions. I mean, that's that we are living in this bizarre moment.
I mean, were the answers wrong, or do they simply no longer suffice?
I think they were the best we could do at that point, but it's everything from, you know, most of what's in the universe is something nobody thought about until 20 years ago, dark matter and dark energy. We just didn't know. And then in our more mundane lives as human societies, you know, we thought we knew what schools should be and prisons and hospitals and politics and economics. And we thought we knew when life began and when death began, and we have had to reimagine all of those things. And we're in this moment where so many of the institutions, or so many of the ways things, I mean, journalism is in the middle of this right now too. The way it worked before suddenly doesn't work anymore. And we're in this in-between time where we can see what's broken. And it's not just that we have to fix it, it's that we have to come up with new forms. And actually, that work of incubating new realities is happening everywhere. The questions are now being asked by, you know, the young journalists, for example, who are going to succeed us. But we're in this in-between time while that experimentation is happening, while that innovation is happening, but before we can see what the forms will be. And again, to come back to my conviction that politics right now is a symptom of the real drama. I mean, this is a very stressful thing. I mean, you know, we're all kind of freaked out on a lot of levels, probably a lot of which we're not even conscious of the known world not making sense anymore.
Would it be accurate to say that we're tackling these questions because, in part, people are now breaking from traditional thought? We are moving to becoming more secular as opposed to Judeo-Christian ethic, et cetera. Is that part of the reason
absolutely.
We're struggling with?
I mean, think about it this way. We are in the first generation of humans who has not inherited religious identity like we inherited hair color and hometown, right? I mean, until just a few decades ago, it's not just that if you were born into a Christian family, you were Christian, or into a Jewish family, you were Jewish, you probably went to the same church or synagogue that your parents and grandparents went to. So, and this has been true of almost every human society across time. So this is where the terrifying and wondrous piece comes in. What that means also is that we are free to craft our spiritual lives. And that is, you know, a lot to ask and also a beautiful thing. And I think even people, and of course everybody's not, you know, there are people still planted in traditions, but even people planted in traditions are asking delving questions, you know, are it's a much more active and proactive process than it ever was before.
If we're free to craft our spiritual lives in the absence of dogma, what does that mean? That means we all have our own systems?
No.
Our own...
I mean, dogma. Doctrine.
Doctrine.
I would say.
Doctrine.
I mean, dogma. I don't know if dogma ever.
I was raised Catholic. Everything's dogma.
Okay, fine. Years ago, I interviewed Yaroslav Pelikan, who was one of the great religious historians of the 20th century. And his last project before he died was studying creeds across the world and across Christian tradition. And he said to me, and I've never forgotten this, the only alternative to tradition is bad tradition. And that is an important thing that, you know, you can give up the creeds that have been passed down through generations and the tradition. But what you do once you get serious about it is you start reinventing tradition.
So it's mind-boggling,
actually. Yeah, which is not resolving our dilemma
but
here.
There are religious traditions that part of the tradition is to ask questions, not to take things at face value, to actually question everything, including scripture. And then there are traditions where you take it at face value. You don't question, because if you question, you might get an answer you don't like or that goes against the tradition that you've been raised. Is that part of the problem, that we are now asking questions? We're not accepting things at face value, and it scares
the dickens out of it. Yeah, I don't think, in the long run, I don't think that unquestioning subservience will be the way people do this or anything, religion or anything. And so that's going to shake everything up. And, of course, what we haven't mentioned the technology, you know, the T word.
I was going to get to that.
Because that's at the heart of all of this, right? And our technology has completely thrown up in the air definitions of things like authority, community, leadership. Once you start having to redefine and remake authority, community, and leadership, you are going to turn every institution inside out.
Well, it's democratized.
Yeah.
Everything. Everybody's opinion is equally valuable. And, well, that's lovely. Everybody's opinion is equally valuable.
That might be my phone.
Is it your phone?
Sorry.
I don't know whether our radio listeners could hear the ringtone, but I will duplicate it for you. I think that's an interesting ringtone for you to have. Would you like to explain that?
No.
Does it mean trouble is calling, or is that somebody you want to talk to? Well, it's interesting that you go off when we're talking about technology.
Yeah.
We are living through the impact of social media on society, and it's changing everything. And not just social media, just technology. The fact that there are no record stores anymore. People read newspapers now online. Everything is converging. Radio does video, television. I mean, newspapers do video and audio. Everybody's doing podcasts. Movie critics have gone by the wayside, because if I want to know what somebody thinks about a movie, I can go to one of the social media apps on my phone and find out what 10,000 people thought of it, even though they're not trained critics. Who cares about all of that has changed. And you have said that for the first time, and I find this to be a startling observation, for the first time in the history of our species, we are developing the connective tools to think and act as a species.
Right.
Are we becoming the Borg? What's going on?
I love Star Trek, too, by the way. But the Borg are a dark
yes, it is.
Potential. I had a great conversation yesterday with some young people from First Presbyterian Church. And, these technologies are transformative in that way. And I'm really resistant to all the ways we kind of talk about the things we've broken and the young people have to grow up and fix. But with this one, I think they are just going to have in their bodies some instincts and intuition about how to grow these technologies up, how to live with them, that is not there for those of us on whom this stuff landed in midlife and we're always on foreign territory.
Kristen Tippett's our guest. We're coming right back from the Duke Energy Theater on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs. This host of PBS's Masterpiece Mystery combines actor and activist into a countercultural performance. April 30th at Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And from Cal Atlantic Homes, offering new homes in the Manor at Oak Haven and Valentine, featuring open floor plans from 2,500 to 3,500 square feet, 36 home sites available. More information at calatlantichomes.com. President Trump is taking on the Republican Freedom Caucus in the House after they helped to defeat the GOP's health care bill. The president has even threatened to target these caucus members in next year's midterm election. Will the president choose to work with Democrats instead? And will Democrats work with him? That's the question they'll be asking in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point with Tom Ashbrook following Charlotte Talks here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
Carol Bowie Jackson, owner of Birdhouse on the Greenway, a WFAE underwriter.
It was a conscious decision to support WFAE because we have been fans for a long time. The demographics for WFAE are very similar to the customer base in our store. They're well-educated, they're well-informed, they're environmentally sensitive and environmentally aware, and we found that there was a big crossover.
Email underwriting at WFAE.org to find out more.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I hope all of you have silenced your cell phones in the audience here at the Duke Energy Theater because Krista Tippett does not like to be interrupted. She's the host of On Being, which is here every Sunday at 7 o'clock. And we do carry the show that you referred to on Sunday evening that you referred to in the last segment. Let me share some emails. I'm going to come back to this technology thing, but let me share some emails with you that have come in while we've been talking. Jenny says, for the last 2 years, having made a choice away from organized religion, I've been using a meditation app and find that I am in a very different and good place in terms of mindfulness. How does mindfulness factor into the search for spirituality?
So, you know, all of our traditions have a contemplative practice in their depths. But Buddhism, this is the thing they've privileged. Like, this is what they have focused on, cultivated over thousands of years. Started bringing it out of the monasteries and to ordinary people a couple hundred years ago, and we've hit the 21st century, and this spiritual technology of calming our minds is exactly what 21st century people need. And it dovetails with what we're learning through neuroscience about how our brains work. In fact, the what I think is one of the most wonderful discoveries we've made that are of neuroplasticity, that our brains keep changing and forming across the lifespan. They don't stop being able to change when you hit 21 or 35. And in fact, that we can change our brains through our behavior. That science was informed by a study with some Tibetan Buddhist monks that the Dalai Lama brought to this neuroscientist at University of Wisconsin-Madison and said, I believe that these intensive practices that we engage in change us, and I'd like you to test this theory.
Gus emails, in John's Gospel, Jesus reconfigures his relationship with the disciples from one of master-slave to a relationship defined by friendship. That's Jesus' word, he says. Jesus then tells his disciples to go out and to befriend others with his friendship. Is there something about friendship that we are missing when it comes to our spiritual lives and how we relate to one another regardless of one's faith?
I love that. Yeah, you know, Christianity makes these audacious claims, right? It has these audacious callings of not just care for the stranger, but, you know, love of enemy. I mean, you know, friendship to the enemy is another way to say it. And, you know, I like to, a language I'm using a lot right now as I think about this moment we're in, I think, you know, this notion of accompanying each other, being companions to each other, and how much we're all longing for that, and how, and really, boy, we can't make that dependent on whether we agree. In fact, I think it behooves us. I think we have a lot of intelligence in our lives, in our personal experience, that we don't take as seriously as we might and apply to our common life. For example, in our circles of friendship, there are people with whom we have a deep bond, and we are going to be with them and that we care about their well-being and we're going to accompany them. But there are all kinds of things we probably don't agree on.
Mm. You know, one of the things that's happening is fear throughout the land.
Yeah.
And I think that might be because of the world becoming so small now. I remember, and I guess many people in the audience remember, when it was a big deal on television when they would say, from coast to coast. Now that it's around the world, it's not just coast to coast, it's instantaneous, and it comes to us on our phones, in our pockets, the entire world. So the distance between, at first that was exciting because we could see these exotic people in exotic situations. But now the other is right in our pocket. Mm-hmm. Is that part of what's making us so nervous?
Yes, we are not hardwired for this. We're in a huge learning curve. We are engineered to go to this fear place with the other. And when we are fearful, for whatever reason, to start to see the other everywhere and guard ourselves against that. And that's the state of our political life right now. Mm-hmm. We're in our, you know, what they call the lizard brains. We're in our lizard brains. It's not a good place to be. We cannot rise to our best selves. And so I think there are many, I'm asking myself and I'm asking other people, you know, to consider, this does feel like a very existential moment, right? It's a crisis moment. And I'm asking, like, I think each of us can have a calling in this moment. What is what is your civic calling in this moment? And for some people, that's going to be very activist. But I think there's a real need in this moment for some of us to pick up a calling of just being calmers of fear. And that might sound really mild, but the truth is, if we don't get ourselves and other people out gently, and that's because it's going to be gentle and quiet work, right? But if we don't get ourselves and others out of this fear place, there's hardly anything we can do that's really powerful and generative.
For most of human existence, we were unaware of the other. We didn't travel a lot. We couldn't travel a lot. People lived in their entire lives within 5 or 10 square miles, never saw anything, never ate any different food. Television and movies and now social media have opened the world to us.
Yeah.
And it's made us afraid. And yet, why? Because back in the day, 500 years ago, when you didn't go anywhere and you didn't know anybody else other than the people in your family or your clan or your neighborhood, that other stuff was strange and weird. But now we can see clearly that there is common ground.
Yeah, sure. If we were logical creatures, that would be absolutely true, but we're not. And where people have a reflexive fear of the other, and of course the other gets projected in many ways. It can be the racial other, the ethnic other, the economic other, as in the Bernie Sanders campaign, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is on every side of the spectrum. There is always a sense of vulnerability behind that. And again, you may look at that person who's vulnerable and say they have no reason to feel that way. They're not threatened. They're privileged, whatever. But again, we're not rational. We're not logical. However, you know, I mean, this is where I feel like some of this really elemental work we have to honor the fact that people feel vulnerable for whatever reason. But that is not an impossible thing to overcome. There are things each of us can do with another person, another human, who feels unseen, who feels vulnerable, to coax them out of that.
Hmm. In the course of doing your civil conversations around the country over these past 6 years or so, you've come up with what you call encouragements. Mm-hmm. So perhaps we need some of those right now. And one of which seems to be hitting us in the face almost every day. It's almost as though it was waiting, I don't know, it was waiting for you to come along, and that is words matter.
Yeah.
Why is that an encouragement, particularly in light of what's going on today? Words matter.
Well, right, and why should that be something we even have to say?
Right.
I think it is because words are just this elemental building block of every day. We all use words all day long so that we just don't think about it. But if you do stop to think about it, I mean, think about the power an exchange of words has in the course of any day, someone else to you or you to someone else, to make someone's day or break someone's day. You know, what greater power do we have? And now what we're seeing is, and again, I think this has been building for a long time, but we just see on steroids how devastating and destructive it is when words are used carelessly. You know, not even just threateningly, just carelessly, recklessly, unthinkingly, or unthinking about the consequences. It's terrible for us. But again, you know, there are the words that are going to be in the newspaper today, but there are the words each and every one of us is using all the time. We have immediate power to shift into a different gear with that.
And this goes back to something you said earlier. I think you used the word tolerance. That, yes, words matter, but perhaps the words that we have been using, as you say, are too small to be using. Tolerance is one of those words. Why?
Mm-hmm. Tolerance is about enduring each other. And it's not about engaging. It doesn't challenge us to care. It doesn't challenge us to be open enough to be surprised by each other. I mean, we, in fact, are trained in a lot of ways to arm ourselves, to represent, to advocate in the spaces we go into. And while those are good skills to have, they actually work against us really meeting the other with any kind of openness and vulnerability, or like just a desire to listen as opposed to a primary desire to speak and be heard.
So how do we find the big words, the words that fit, either telling us how to live or explaining how we do live, how we do feel? How do we find those words?
Well, I mean, one thing I'm really big on is rediscovering the form of words we call a question, right?
Huh?
we're trained to carry our answers vigorously. And I feel that this is a moment where we need to start carrying our questions more vigorously. And I mean,
we have
to mean it when we ask the questions. So there's internal work that we have to do.
You and I ask questions all the time.
Yeah.
So what does that mean to us? And what does it mean to people who don't ask questions all the time?
I think that asking questions goes together with listening, which goes together with curiosity, which goes together with a willingness to be surprised. And those are not things that get cultivated in us culturally. We learn to speak, we learn to hold opinions, we learn to argue.
Are you also saying that some people ask questions that they've already, by the way they ask the question, they have given you the answer?
Yes, just like you do. Just like that. That's what we're good at. And look, what do we have modeled? If you watch TV or if you watch a presidential debate, nothing is going to happen. I mean, there may be somebody who embarrasses themselves, right? That's the best we hope for, is that somebody gets slipped up or they do something that we'll be able to pick apart later. It is not about asking an open-hearted, generous question and creating a space in which it would, in fact, be reasonable to give an open-hearted, generous answer. We have to recreate the opportunity for that to happen.
And at the crux of this is one of your other encouragements. And this may sound mamby-pamby to a lot of people, but I'll let you take 90 seconds and explain it. A little less than that, actually. this is what I'm really good at, asking you to explain the theory of life in 10 seconds.
Okay.
Love.
Love, yes.
Love.
We have actually started to take hate seriously. We have created a legal category. We have seen how ugly and violent we can get, that we're not rational, that this is a potential we have. And I think this has created an opening for us to start to take love seriously as the only thing big enough to meet those darkest potentials of ourselves, and actually as a successor, not a successor, but a companion to tolerance. And social reformers who have shifted the world on its axis have always called humanity to love. King absolutely called humanity to love. That his change was, you know, secondarily about politics and economics and primarily about creating the beloved community. But it's like civility. It has to be adventurous and muscular and robust and practical. I'm not talking about romantic love.
Right.
I'm talking about practical care. And that is another, so this then creates another challenge for us to completely, and again, our private lives are the best training ground for this, because love means so many different things with the people we love the most, and it often has nothing to do with how we feel at the moment.
Krista Tippett is host of On Being. I have another question, but I'm not going to answer. I'm going to save you from answering the question of life in 10 seconds. She hosts On Being every Sunday morning at 7 o'clock here on WFAE, and she's traveling the country with her Civil Conversations Project. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.